Good morning, world diners and travelers. Are you ready to hear some interesting thoughts about things to eat and places to go? And good morning, Peter.
If you are, then you came to the right place, because this is once again On the Menu Radio. Welcome to our Sunday morning that we share with you and listeners around the world. How nice it is to have you with us again. If you're a first-time visitor in particular, welcome to the On the Menu family. Any of you, drop us an email if you have suggestions, if you have thoughts or comments, things you'd like us to cover, places you haven't been that you'd like to know more about. After all, it's our objective to serve, not to serve and protect like the police, but to serve the dining.
Boy, I mean, I just give you an inch and you take over the whole program. Whatever are you going on about?
I'm going to have to turn your volume down.
For that,
I'm turning your volume down.
I see.
Oh, yeah, you're coming loud and clear. I woke you up this morning. Well, what are we doing this morning?
Okay, well, we still have interviews from when we had so much fun at the Fancy Food Show, and I'm really fond of these next guests. I mean, they took a gold in outstanding chocolate.
And why don't we just hear from them, because they tell their story better than we can.
Brandon Weimer and Leah Post, you may be the youngest guests we've ever had on the Menu Radio. Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Now, your story is, first of all, I want to say your product, which is Brandini Toffee, which just took a gold at the National Association of Specialty Food Trade, the Fancy Food Show in New York, and it deserved a gold. It's fabulous.
Oh, well, thank you.
Oh, yeah. As I said, I can't stop eating it. I'm so sorry I still have some left.
Do we have any left? I thought I ate the last piece.
No, you didn't.
I didn't eat the last piece.
And
okay.
Actually, I promised some for my trainer. But
Okay.
You've got an incredible story. You told us a little. How did this happen? How old are you both?
17.
You're both 17.
And Leah's 16.
Yeah.
17 and 16. And you did this when you started this company at age 15?
Yes.
And how did it happen?
Well, Brandon and I had been friends since preschool, since we were 4 years old. And our freshman English teacher told us that she wanted to take a group the following year for spring break to Italy. And Brandon and I both decided that we wanted to go and thought that our parents would support it and want us to go and, you know, experience another culture. And when we presented them with the idea, they said, well, that's great, but you guys are going to have to pay for half the trips yourself. So we were both 15 at the time, too young to get jobs, and didn't want to do the car wash, the babysitting. So Brandon had been making this almond toffee for about 5 years, and everyone loved it. So we decided to start making it and selling it. And our parent really thought it was a great idea. They saw it as a great business investment and decided to see how far it could go. So we started making it, and we got a website up, and within 6 weeks had paid off both trips in full plus spending money, and we hadn't even hit the holidays yet. So,
well, how did you sell so much of it when nobody had tasted it and you just had it on your website?
Well, we sent the URL for our website out to all of our friends and family, everyone we knew, and then they ordered it, and then they sent it out to their friends and family, and it was very just word of mouth.
Yeah.
We got on the local TV stations, the local newspaper, and pretty soon the whole community was behind it ordering toffee, so we were there every day after school making it.
Were you making it in your kitchen?
No, we were making it at the hotel kitchen, where my dad's general manager of a hotel, and at a hotel locally. So we were just making it there out of a little space in the corner. So,
and how much could you make in a day?
There we had, when it was just us making it, we'd only make, I mean, I don't even think we made 100 pounds a day. And now we're up to, I mean, we're capable of making 300 pounds a day right now. And we're about to make our batches even bigger.
And who makes it now? You don't do this
yourself. Right now we have about 5 full-time employees, and then during the holidays we'll have minimum 10 employees in the kitchen the whole time. So,
and it's still in the same hotel kitchen?
No, now we have our own kitchen, actually, in La Quinta, or in Old Town La Quinta, which is where we live, and it's the commercial kitchen that it was a restaurant, so we have a lot of space to store all of our boxes and everything.
Now the town is where, guys? I've forgotten.
Wait, what?
Where do you live?
In La Quinta. So, yeah, we're just still in the city.
La Quinta, California.
Okay, that's the piece that I wanted at the end. The only La Quinta I know is a cheap motel chain.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
No.
No,
not that one.
No, we're near Palm Springs area in Southern California.
Okay, I got you. Now the name is intriguing for a number of reasons. First of all, because of what it is, and then because of what it isn't. Can you tell us that story again?
The company name is Brandini Toffee, and when we were first starting out, we decided we needed to come up with a name, obviously, and I have been calling Brandon Brandini since we were about 4 years old, and when we were sitting there pitching ideas to each other, Brandon really wanted to try and incorporate my name into it, and I said, well, you know, I gave you the nickname, Brandini sounds Italian, which is what, you know, we're saving for Italy, it's catchy, and it was your recipe to begin with, so we all voted and decided that it would be Brandini Rocca because the candy is actually almond Rocca. However, our very first call on our business line was from Brown and Haley, who owns almond Rocca, and they told us that we needed to change our name right away because Rocca was trademarked. So since then, we have become Brandini Toffee.
It's funny. We were in we met a winemaker in northeastern Italy whose last name was Gallo, and the people from Modesto, California, apparently came calling on them and said, "You can't call your wine Gallo," even though it's the winemaker and vineyard owner's last name. So they changed it to something else.
Oh wow!
I guess if you have a trademark, you're a real bully about it.
Yeah, definitely.
Now, what else, have you learned anything else aside from the fact that you better be careful what trade name you use?
We've learned a lot. Being not only about owning the business and the business aspects of it, but because we're still in high school, we're both honor students, and Brandon's a varsity debater. I'm a varsity swimmer, so we've really had to learn time management and being able to juggle so much on our plate at one time. And that's what's so great about having both of us, because sometimes Brandon or I will say, you know, we have too much homework or we have a huge test coming up, and then we can just swap and trade places. And we've really had to learn a lot about the business. The parents keep us involved in every step of the process because we're not 18. We don't legally own any percentage of the company yet. So the parents really help out, and they do a lot for us, and they keep us involved every step of the way.
And what did it feel like when the award came up at the SOFA and they announced all the finalists, and then they said the winner is?
It was a huge rush, because compared to, like, I mean, we were up against all the big companies that we've all looked up to in the, you know, making of our company, and so when we actually heard our name, I think we're just both shocked to hear that.
You looked excited. Yeah, we were there.
yeah,
we were there.
Brandon and I just kind of sat there and looked at each other for, you know, a couple seconds before we actually stood up and walked up to the stage, and it was just such an honor, and we were, you know, so happy, and everyone was so nice to us there. Considering, you know, we're the youngest ones to ever be admitted into the Fancy Food Show, let alone win the Gold Sophie.
So. And I see in the press release here that Jamie Enstrom visited your booth at your very first Fancy Food Show.
Yep.
Yes.
Yeah, we have him scheduled for an interview coming up.
Oh, we do?
Yeah.
I don't know him.
For the toffee product.
Oh, he's another. Oh, he's
also
the
finalist.
He's the other toffee guy.
Yeah, and Shom's Almond Toffee. They're so nice, and we were actually up against another brand, Stephanie's Almond Toffee, and Enstrom's owns them. And
yes, exactly.
So it was so nice, and everyone in the food industry is just so nice to us. We have Gary Guittard from Guittard Chocolate,
oh,
who we
wow.
use, and they, you know, help us every step of the way. We know people from Jelly Belly and Enstrom's Almond Toffee, and even people from Almond Rocca, and everyone just comes over and is so nice to us and helps us out and gives us advice, you know, to be in the industry and lets us know, you know, how much they care, which is just really amazing.
Well, now what happens, like, you're going to be going off to college? I mean, are you going to continue a company that makes a single product, or are you going to continue and expand it in candy making, or are you going to major in... What, are you going to major in archaeology or something?
No, we're both going to stick to something that will help the business, such as, you know, business and marketing. But we want to just keep our one product for now. We'd like to just keep that product, and that's what it seems all the other toffee companies do. It's just you're good at one product, might as well stick with it and not try to do something totally different.
So.
And then when we go off to college next year, we both have younger sisters who will be entering high school, and they're best friends as well. So they'll kind of take over and be the face of the company for the things that we can't be doing. And they're 12 years old right now, almost 13, and they know how to make it, pack it, sell it, anything. So.
Oh, what amazing stories.
Here's the only question I want to ask you. What are you going to be when you grow up?
The next See's Candy, of course.
I mean, maybe you want to do something easy, like be President of the United States. or governor of California.
In all of our spare time.
I mean, there'll be an opening as governor of California, because I guess Arnold will have finished up.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I'll tell you, I mean, this is a treat for us to interview people so delightful, and it's such a good story just for everybody.
It's a Horatio Alger story brought up to date into the 21st century, and I think I only have one question for you, because you're obviously so smart. If we want to attract more listeners who are in high school to On the Menu Radio, how should we reach out to them?
I think just doing what you guys are doing, probably... It's hard for kids to listen, you know, about wine because we can't drink, but...
How's food?
Yeah, food, just, you know, teenage food, I guess, teenage stories. Yeah. I know a lot of the kids in the Valley like to listen or hear our story because we're so out of the ordinary, and parents like them listening because we're the kids that, you know, aren't getting in trouble doing it all.
You don't have time to get in trouble.
Yeah, how about we send you this story and you can put it on your website.
All right, of course. Yeah, definitely.
Great deal. Thank you so much, both of you. Congratulations again on your award, and all we can say is we don't have to wish you ever success in the future because we know you're going to have it.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for having us.
Okay, thank you. Well, that was an inspiring story, and now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, here we are again, and it's the usual time when we give out our email address. It's onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com. And now I think, actually, you should move in on this, since you were the one that went to this next restaurant.
And it won't be entirely clear when we start this without I give it an introduction, because it's not every day that you find an excellent Italian restaurant in the county of Yorkshire in north of England, where I was born. But I did find one just doing research about dining establishments around the world, as we always do. And on a recent short trip to England, I had the opportunity to arrange a visit with a restaurant called Nonna's. And I talked to the general manager and also to the chef. I'm going to play their interviews back to back. But just in case you're wondering about this dramatic switch in direction, hang with the program, because the section after this one is by an author and a great foodie. Oh, he doesn't like to be called a foodie, a gourmet traveler.
He hates
to be a foodie, called Fred Plotkin. And Fred Plotkin knows about all the Italian restaurants in Italy, but I bet he doesn't know about Nonna's in Sheffield.
Peter used to visit Sheffield when he was growing up because it was a city where they made steel, and the making of steel and the making of cutlery was an interesting process. But it certainly wasn't a mecca of fine dining. Fast forward to 2008, and Peter's making a brief visit to the city of Sheffield and doing that because he read about a fine restaurant in Sheffield that he thought deserved a visit. So here I am at Nonna's on Eccles Hall Road, just outside the city of Sheffield, talking to Daniel Jackson, who's, I think, the director of marketing for this restaurant. And he's going to tell us how the story got started about 12 years ago.
So Nonna's 12 years ago used to be just a coffee bar, opened by two Italian English gentlemen, Maurizio and Jan. And over the last 12 years, we've just grown gradually from a coffee bar to a light lunch restaurant, and then into a fine dining restaurant, and more recently an aperitivo bar, followed by a lovely Nonna's Cucina, which is our delicatessen separate to Nonna's.
So this is a little bit of Tuscany, a little bit of Toscana in South Yorkshire?
We like to think so, and we actually develop ourselves to be more of a training establishment for Sheffield people, and we have great links with Montecatini in Tuscany, and a lovely house in Tuscany that we rent out to our guests.
So on the ceiling above us, I guess you can't call it a mural because that would be on the wall, but on the ceiling above us is a depiction of Civitas Sheffield as if it was a town in somewhere in central Italy. The owners masquerading as St. Francis and somebody else up there. Do you know how they got the idea to do this in the first place?
With the two owners and myself, it's lots of viewing around other cities, and because we've all been into Tuscany many times, the painting has always been at the forefront of their mind, and to do something just with a little bit of fun, a bit of tongue-in-cheek. And actually, one of the owners, Jan, visited the Uffizi in Florence and picked up two paintings, which are now the murals on the to represent the toilets for the gent and the lady. So that's a really nice thing.
He picked them up from the Uffizi. I mean, they were for sale. I'm expecting to see a Botticelli around the corner just at any moment. But there's a fascination with things Italian. And you said one of the founders comes from Tuscany, the other one comes from the breadbasket of Italy, Emilia Romana. So they had their heart in the right place. How did they manage to survive without the kind of food that they're cooking here now when they were so Italian-oriented? Did they have family members who cooked in this way, or did they discover it for themselves?
Well, nonnas obviously means grandmother in Italian, and both Jan and Maurizio's grandmothers played a real focus in their lives when they were younger. And Jan's grandmother used to have a little shop in Emilia Romagna that he just used to love walking around. So on the first day of the opening, the grandmother actually cut the ribbon to welcome the guests. And they've just grown. They didn't expect to be so busy, and they didn't expect to be at this level now. But that's just time and good management.
Now, is this a busy place? I mean, you got some attention recently, and I came across Nonna's through Decanter magazine, which gave the restaurant a very strong rating. There's another award that I'm going to ask Daniel to explain in just a second. So it's on the people's radar screen across the country now. Are people coming from further afield, or is it still a local audience that you're catering for?
People are coming from all around the country, and especially more recently London-based businesses all tend to know who we are, and we always hear lots of stories about bank managers sat in meetings in London, and they're saying, oh, is Nonna's still on Ecclesall Road? And of course the answer is yes. But the new award for us is the AA Notable Wine List Award that we've just received, and we're actually in the final of that wine list award up against all the top London restaurants, which is very exciting for us.
Now, you were also listed in the Observer Food Monthly's Best of the Rest restaurants. Explain a little bit about what that rating means.
Like America, we're not as big as America, but as a country, we have a lot of regions, and the Observer Food Monthly Awards was for the best restaurants in the country, and regionally, we were mentioned regionally as the only one in South Yorkshire, so we're very, very happy on that.
Well, that has to be pretty thing. Now, we talked to Anthony, you know Anthony Flynn, and I know, Daniel, you've told me, in Leeds, and when we were there, he said people used to come up from London on the train for lunch or for dinner, and the same kind of thing is happening here?
That's correct, and even just on Saturday night, we had a lovely couple up from London who just came up to Sheffield and Derbyshire for the weekend, and strangely enough, a couple from Bradford was up on the weekend just to come to Nonna's, and that was all they were coming for.
Now, this is an interesting location. It's a rather eclectic street. I'm looking across the street, and someone just turned into the street driving an Aston Martin DB9, which many of you will know is the James Bond car. So there's something about this neighborhood that's kind of interesting. But, Daniel, you said that when you first came here 12 years ago, this was basically an empty street. So something's changed in that period of time.
That's correct. And it was an empty street. There was nothing happening on the street. And it was great for us to get in early because now it's a real fine dining area. But the area close to us, called Hallam, is actually the fourth richest part of England. So we benefit from Ferraris, Aston Martins, Lamborghinis outside. But our core customer could be the students who live locally, or people drinking Cristal on a Saturday night. It's a real mix and a great atmospheric place.
People are planning on coming for dinner, and especially on the weekend. Would it be very important that they get in touch and make a reservation?
Definitely, and they can do that with the website or by telephoning. But I would highly recommend booking on Tuesday night. We didn't have any people booked in, but we still filled the restaurant twice over. So it's a very strange place and always busy.
The directions are challenging, but if you know the English motorway system, the restaurant really is about 15 minutes away from the Meadow Hall shopping center exit on the M1. Good luck with directions. I found it here making only one small wrong turning, but it is quite a challenge. I'm expecting it's going to be easier going back because all I'm going to have to do is follow signs for the M1. But is there a tip? I mean, is there an easy way?
The majority of people in Sheffield know where we are. I would say the easy way is a route planner. or a satellite navigation system is always the best way. But yeah, it can be quite complicated, and they're always navigating the roads in Sheffield, as Sheffield's such a bulging city right now.
So there's a lot going on, but Nonna's is the place to come. Make a note of it. Be sure to replicate the experience that I'm about to have. I've had food sitting in front of me for about 10 minutes already. It's really very tempting. I'm going to ask Chef Jamie, whose last name I've forgotten, so he can introduce himself with his last name. And we have a little antipasti ahead of me here, so I'm going to ask him to tell me what that is, and then I'm going to take the opportunity to tuck in. And Jamie will come back to us in just a few minutes and take us through the entire menu concept. But Jamie, welcome to On the Menu.
Hi, my name's Jamie Taylor. I've been head chef at Nonna's for the past 3 years now, and I've been here 5 years in total. So the food that Peter's actually going to be eating today is just a little antipasti plate. We've got a classic Tuscan bread soup, which is a papa pomodoro. We've got monkfish spiedini with sweet and sour aubergine with cherry tomatoes. Chicken liver parfait with a taleggio and truffle oil crostini, and a small bit of citrus cured salmon with pickled dill cucumbers and potato pancake.
Sounds like a great way to start. Well, Peter has the most glorious looking plate of dessert in front of him. That's really not why we're here, because the next part of the On the Menu program from Nonna's in Sheffield is to talk to Chef Jamie Taylor about what they're trying to do here in the kitchen. Jamie, first of all, welcome to On the Menu.
Thank you. Thanks for coming.
And, you really got your start in the cooking business with an old friend of On the Menu named...
Raymond Blanc. My first job from college, I did my stage at Le Manoir for 3 months, and then Raymond Blanc offered me a job straight away. And I stayed there for 18 months, learning a good trade. You know, seeing a lot of things. It's a really good experience.
Have you actually had the opportunity to go back? I mean, he's doing some really interesting things now.
No, unfortunately, I've not really had a chance to go back. I'd love to do it again, maybe take my wife down to stay. Anniversary coming up soon, so you never know.
Save all your pennies if you go for your anniversary. This is an expensive ticket. One of the interesting things they're doing, and I'm going to spring this on you, only because I just thought of it and I didn't have a chance to talk about it with Daniel. One of the projects that they have is a huge kitchen garden. Now, you haven't talked about having one of those, but is that something you think you might do?
It would be an idea, but unfortunately, being in a city, there's not really much scope for having his own garden. You know, it's quite a concrete jungle roundabout, lots of student houses, things like that. So unless we have window baskets or something like that, maybe it's a possibility.
But you do have the opportunity to be able to locavore shop by getting many of your ingredients from the immediate vicinity, correct?
Yeah, we try and keep things... as local as possible, you know, our meat and things like that, based within the Seven Hills of Sheffield, just like Rome, Seven Hills of Rome.
Now the Seven Hills of Sheffield expand just a little bit larger geographically than the Seven Hills of Rome, now, I'm guessing, correct?
I guess so. I'm not really 100% sure on the...
You sort of run out of houses, within the Seven Hills of Sheffield, you run out of houses and there are real fields, that's what I meant.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. There would be, you know, we could possibly have our own allotment, things like that. Could be something in the pipeline soon. Would be nice to do.
Now Sheffield is an interesting kind of town, but not one with a great culinary tradition. But you're from this area, right?
Yeah, actually born in West Yorkshire, but I've lived in South Yorkshire most of my life. You know, went away and come back, tried to do something and make a name for myself in Sheffield, in South Yorkshire, really.
But your hometown is Barnsley, and there's a Barnsley... name of a dish on your menu.
Yep, it's that goes back to the butcher as well. It's a nice local dish, and it's quite a popular one on the new menu. You know, like I said, try and keep things local.
Now, we forgot to mention this is called a Barnsley chop. Now, what just quickly for our listeners, what makes a Barnsley chop a Barnsley chop?
I don't actually know where the name derived from. It's from the back end of the saddle, so it's like a double best end of joint, really.
And a slab, correct?
Yeah, it's a nice thick cut of meat, centre bone running straight down, you get your two loins off the saddle and two little bits of fillet underneath. It's a lovely bit of meat.
Okay, now, this is an Italian-inspired menu, but being cooked by a very English Yorkshireman. Can you give us a pathway through the menu, Jamie?
Yeah, all the staff in the kitchen are British, so we all have to work just a little bit harder to try and source the ingredients, recipes, things like that. So, you know, we do a lot of research, books, websites, even the two owners, Italian, give us a lot of background. And, you know, we try and typically Italian dishes, but try and do them with a British twist. Try and keep it nice and modern.
So your bread, your Tuscan bread soup has a kind of a spicy ingredient?
That comes from my boss, Maurizio. He likes things nice. He likes things spicy, just a little bit of warmth at the back as you're eating it.
And you make your own house-smoked salmon, but then you serve that with a well-marinated cucumber, I think?
Yeah, just a pickled dill cucumber, a few coriander seeds, a bit of honey, white wine vinegar.
And the chicken pate with the truffle cheese, bruschetta?
Yeah, they're local chickens, local chicken livers. It's made with the reduction, lots of butter, very healthy for you. And they say with a taleggio and truffle oil crostini, which is a little bit different. It's like, instead of in your nice long crostini, served in like a sandwich sort of style.
Now let's move over to the seafood side of the menu, because that's something that, as a small island, which is what we're both sitting on today, the distance from landing the fish is very short. So you told me just a second ago how it comes, but explain to our listeners, first of all, among the appetizers, you serve the monkfish, and then as a main course, some delicious scallops.
Yeah, we use two fish suppliers, one on the east coast for like the smaller orders, and we use one on the south coast, the Devon coast, for our larger orders. The orders come in on the catchers come in on the morning, the fish supplier rings us up, we place the order, and the order gets delivered straight from Devon to Nonna's in Sheffield.
So it was landed yesterday, you know what you have, and then you said they have the key to the freezer?
Yeah, they've got a key to our back, walk-in fridge at the back, so the fish comes in, they put it in the fridge, we come in the following morning, and then they prep it, fresh as a daisy.
And you slid some duck in there, but on the menu there's also beef. And those are from local suppliers also?
Yeah, that's our butcher. We get all our meat comes from our local butcher, and his motto is everything, all the meat that he supplies is from, it's within the 30-mile radius of Sheffield, based within the Seven Hills.
And facing us now, as I came into the conversation, we have just a plethora of dolce.
We've just done a little lasciata for Peter, just try a few little different things. It's same again, it's traditional Italian, but with a little English twist. It's like we've got a classic tiramisu on there, and also we've got an egg custard with poached peaches. And we've got a bitter chocolate brownie with white chocolate parfait, and a little twist on carrot cake, which is a zucchini and walnut cake with a passion fruit cream.
I'm going to go back to Daniel, because he's sneakingly been doing some excellent wine pairing for us. This is a wine list that is 99.9% Italian. He said we have one honorary Italian wine called Seghesio Family Vineyard Zinfandel from California, but everything else is sourced from Italy. What's the inspiration behind that?
Well, obviously we try and stay Italian as much as we can. For a wine tasting a while ago, we did it in America versus Italy night. Which is when we put on the Seghesio, and it was fantastic. And it's actually bottled under Stelvin, so it's a screw cap, but it doesn't affect the quality, and it makes for a great tasting for some guests when they try the Primitivo versus the Seghesio Zinfandel.
But if listeners, if you come, you got to ask for Daniel or somebody else with the right kind of experience to navigate it, because there'll be a lot of labels that you've never heard of. It would be my guess.
That's correct, and all of our staff are trained to the Wine, Spirits, and Education Trust level 2. So all of our staff are very well versed on wines, and of course I think 90% of our staff are Italian out front, so they know their own wines, but they tend to sell wines from their region, so it's a bit of a political minefield out there. But the wines that I've matched you with today, I've got a nice dessert wine here for you, which is the Vigna Moragne Ricciotto di Suave, which is a Verona, sort of northern Italy Pasito sweet wine, and that'll be a nice combination with some of these desserts.
And there's lots of new news going to be coming out of Nonna's, which we promise you'll find out about from on the menu. Nonna's in new places, Nonna's in new concepts, so we'll just save that as something you'll have to come to www.onthemenuradionews. So last thought, either Daniel or Jamie?
We're just really pleased that we've shown up on the American radar, and we're very pleased that you took your time to come down and meet us today and navigate through the busy roads of England. And hopefully you've enjoyed it as much as we have.
Absolutely have. It's been a whole lot of fun, and Miss Anne's going to be jealous, but what can I do?
Actually, I'm not at all jealous, but it is time now to pause.
For the cause, and we'll talk to you on the other side.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, welcome back. Here we are again. You know, Rabbit, it's funny that listening to the menu and the Italian dishes with a North of England accent struck me. It reminded me of the first time I was in Rome and went to a Chinese restaurant, and I was absolutely astounded that the waiters spoke Italian instead of English. It shows how...
or perhaps even instead of Chinese. You can never tell.
It just shows how parochial English speakers are.
There's always a little something new going on to surprise everybody, even Miss Anne. And even though she thinks she's probably seen just about everything, there's always a chance that she might not have. And here's a man who knows lots and lots of things we don't even know. This is the...
He knows so much, Fred Plotkin. I'm amazed.
We could have kept him on for a whole program and...
Several programs.
Yes, maybe several programs. But the thing to do is get his book, and that's referenced in the interview that's just upcoming. So over to Fred.
Hello, Fred Plotkin.
Buongiorno.
Buongiorno. And I really feel like you're my best friend, even though I've never talked to you before. Do you have that effect on a lot of people?
Well, many people tell me that when they travel with my book, Italy for the Gourmet Traveler, that they refer to it as Fred. And what does Fred say? Has Fred been here? He has. How does Fred get everywhere?
Well, that's a good question. I remember asking the wine writer, Leslie Serbaglia. I said, how did you manage to have opinions about all these wines? You said you can't possibly have drunk all of them. She says, I have, and a whole lot more. So you must be in the same position.
But the difference is the wine can come to you, whereas if you're writing about a city or a place, you have to go to it.
Absolutely. So
that's the difference.
So this book...
And also, when wine comes to you, you can drink it at home and not have to drive.
Well, Brenda, how... You know more about Italy than anybody I know. I mean, what does it take to get to know a country this well?
Well, I think part of it is just a crazy passion, which I certainly have. A second thing is my background is a bit unusual. I'm a New Yorker, New York City. I grew up surrounded by people of all nations. I very early on experienced the passion for Italy, in part because I saw Michelangelo's Pietà here in New York when I was 8 years old. And that just changed everything for me, and I had to go. The other thing is that my career interest was opera, which is still the main thing that I do. I direct opera, I coach singers, I've managed opera companies, I appear on the Metropolitan Opera broadcast intermissions, and I wrote the book everyone uses to learn opera. It's called Opera 101. But if you want to learn opera, you go to Italy to do your training. At least that's what I thought.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went to university in Italy. I went to the University of Bologna.
Oh, so you weren't. Okay.
Traveled all over the country while living in Bologna, and then got a Fulbright scholarship, and I lived in Milan, and I directed opera at La Scala.
Oh, wow.
And Italy was in every way my life from a working point of view, and I studied everything, but not with the idea that I would then use it in a work context. So I did have to eat twice a day at least, and I traveled all over the country, and I discovered through my travels how distinct every region, every province is, and how fantastically different the food was, and I just learned it. And I think when people do this not for research but for pleasure, they take in a lot more, and they take it in differently.
Well, this book is so dense with information. It's called Italy for the Gourmet Traveler, and you say it's a fourth revision.
Yes.
And tell us how it's organized.
The book is organized by regions. Italy has 20 regions, which is like saying an American state or province elsewhere, but let's be very specific that they're called regions in Italy, and within them are what are called provinces. And a province is like a county, and it has its main city. So that the province of Parma, or the province of Savona, or the province of Siena, means that this chief town governs the areas around it and is the political and often academic center of the province. And so I divided the book into the regions, and then refer to each province when there is something worth knowing. There are 107 provinces in Italy, and I've been to all 107 many times. And keep going back. That's another point. The book would become out of date almost the second one would publish it if one didn't keep it up to date.
Well, this is true.
So that's why I keep going back, not only to check on places that I've written about before, but also to find new places. But occasionally I get a letter from a reader saying, don't you know that they've changed their closing time from Saturday to Thursday? And I write back thanking the reader for keeping me up to date, because I can't be omniscient in that way.
Right.
But what this book does reflect, and what I'm most proud of, is I saw, I tasted, and I noted every single thing in the book. Most travel books are written by committee with staffs, and we don't necessarily know how prepared, how competent the people are writing those books. This really is a little bit an autobiography of my tongue and my nose and my eyes. It's pleasure activism written over 726 pages.
Now, you did tell us there's more than just food in here, though, because of the breadth of your interest, and also because of your feeling that in order to equip a traveler or a tourist properly, they need to know a lot more than just where to eat and drink.
Well, I'm not a fan of the word foodie, which I hear other people use, because foodie has too much of an acquiring sound. I believe that we were given these beautiful things called our senses to really use. So if I write about a town in the book, I try to point you to things to see, to touch, to taste, to hear, and to smell. And all of that comes together to make a really sublime experience. So you can do almost all of that at a table. But if I can also send you to a fascinating store that has nothing to do with food but tells you about the place, or if I send you to a particular bakery and say that this is where a particular composer went because he liked this bakery rather than the one down the street, that tells you more about the composer. It also tells you more about the particular place than go in and get the chocolate cake. I don't care about that. Why is the chocolate cake interesting is a lot more more important to me.
So you prepared this book, and you did it chronologically by region and province with the intention of saying, it doesn't matter where you're going in Italy, I'll have some information for you?
No, not chronologically, but geographically. It's more to the point that I try to find places that I think are interesting. So no one you'll ever meet, really, including most Italians, knows Javera del Montello. Most people couldn't tell you where that is.
Yeah, I don't know where it is.
It's near Treviso. And I picked it because another thing to know about me, I don't know how to drive. I'm from New York City.
So you're a New Yorker.
Yes. So therefore, I go about on public transportation in Italy. I take boats and trains and buses. I walk a lot. I go by bicycle. I've been known to go by horse every so often. And I talk to everyone. I speak Italian, of course. And I chat with everyone. And Italian men on trains don't talk about sex terribly much. They don't talk about politics terribly much. They get too upset. They don't talk about their wives or their girlfriends terribly much. What they talk about, and a little bit they talk about soccer. What they really talk about is food. What did you eat at your last meal? What are you going to eat at your next meal? And I immediately plunge into these conversations, and I say, sir, where are you from? And he might say, oh, you wouldn't know, it's a town called Javera del Montello. So where is it, I would ask. And he would say, well, I'm going there now. Where are you going, sir? I'm going to Treviso. Well, come to Javera. And I would go there. He would have no clue what I do, because then he'd say, why do you speak Italian? Well, I work in opera. That's the end of that. No reason to ask any further. So he has no idea that I'm completely attuned to the food. Mm-hmm. And I would go into a little trattoria, such as the Agnoletti, which I like very much, in Javera, and eat as would anyone else. And they would have no idea that I'm really taking lots of notes, with the idea that I would present this to a reader. And why do I do that? Because if everyone just goes to Rome, Florence, and Venice, wonderful though they are,
right,
you're missing the experience of a fantastic country with more culinary treasures than any other in the world.
Well, now we're going to this book to the test, because we're going to go to Emilia Romagna, and Anne hasn't looked up the page it starts on yet, so she's going to have to go to the to the front to find out what page Emilia Romagna is, because it turns out on the menus going there, destination, first destination, Bologna, in about 2 months' time.
Right.
So, Madame, quickly turn to Emilia Romagna.
Let's see, here it is, 346.
Okay, so the first step is to go to page 346.
Mm-hmm.
And when I get there, what do I do?
Well, that's what we're going to ask Fred. Fred's now our guide.
I'm here, Emilia Romagna.
Well, let me first correct the pronunciation because it's important. Emilia Romagna.
Yes.
Many years ago, I wanted to write a cookbook about this region. Many years ago. There is, of course, the great book by Lynn Casper called The Splendid Table. But even before she did that, I proposed a book to a publisher, and I said, I want to write a book about Emilia Romagna. And they said, oh, is that your girlfriend? And the point here is, our collective knowledge has galloped in many ways about Italy, and we have more points of references now than we did 25 or 30 years ago when I first started trying to write this stuff. I'm 52, just to give you a context. And so I was not offered a book contract on Emilia Romagna because it was felt no one knows anything about it. Mm-hmm. So I wrote a book called The Authentic Pasta Book. I didn't like the title because you can never call food authentic. I called it Pasta Diva. And I divided Italy into regions and discussed the pasta of each region. It turned out that was the first book ever written directly in English. It was a cookbook that explained Italy regionally. And it influenced all kinds of other writers who were full-time food writers to write about regions. So Lynn wrote her fantastic book on Emilia Romagna. Arthur Schwartz wrote a great book about Naples, Campania. Nancy Jenkins on Puglia, and so forth. There are many fine books on all the regions, almost all the regions. And Emilia-Romagna...
There's a particularly fine one about Friuli that just happens to be written by an author called Fred.
Yes, it's called... what is it called? La Terra Fortunata.
Yeah, exactly. We have a copy of it downstairs. Anyway, we're going to turn now to Bologna.
All right. I should also say I wrote a book called Recipes from Paradise, which is about the Italian Riviera.
Okay.
Oh, yeah?
Which is where I live.
So did we,
you have a house there. Is that the...
Yes.
So
that's really the closest to my heart, but I love all the regions.
What city in...
I'll never tell.
Oh, okay. Is this the one that...
A couple of times it's gotten out, I've had people show up at my door demanding for them.
Oh, no. But is it, because there was you posed a question about your favorite city at the opening of the...
Right. I live in a little town in Liguria. It's called the Italian region of Liguria.
And is that your favorite city?
I don't call it a city. It's really a town of 600 people. Bologna has 600,000 people. And Bologna, which is the capital of Emilia-Romagna, is my favorite city.
Great.
Far and away. And most Italians say to you, my favorite city is the town where I live plus Bologna.
Okay.
And Bologna has so much that we think of as classically Italian. It has stupendous architecture. It has 3 Michelangelo sculptures. It has one of the most beautiful piazzas in all of Italy. It has divine food. It has what I think are the best food markets in Italy by far. And I always say that I got my master's in gastronomy in the markets of Bologna, because most markets that a visitor reading my book would go to, it would be, let's get some peaches and some prosciutto to have a picnic. But if you go to the great markets of Italy, among them Bologna, Genoa, Padova, there are a few others that are just extraordinary, you can get this great education in how food is used.
Yeah, I remember the one in Padova. That was the one that made the strongest impression on me of all the ones we've done, and we've been to lots of them.
I usually rank Padova's market second best in Italy to Bologna.
Okay.
Great. Well, then we know.
And Genoa would be third.
Then we know where our first stop is going to be, don't we, Mrs. Haig?
Yes.
Well, actually, there's more than one.
Okay, go ahead.
There are 2 major markets. One of them goes back to the Middle Ages in Bologna, and there are literally these little wells in the ground, and people come up out of the ground, as they've done since the 1300s, and they place their goods on a few little stands, and then at the end of the day, they draw everything back in again. It's very odd, and for the uninitiated, it's quite strange. And if you go to the museum in Bologna and you see the paintings by Nibale Carracci of the market, these are the paintings of the Bologna market 500 years ago.
Oh, wonderful.
And you see how little things have changed, and that's why I put museums in my travel book for food lovers, because you can see how art represents food.
Well,
now, in Bologna, would go around the markets not once a day, but twice a day. And the reason for that is when I lived there, I would say, well, okay, what do I feel like for lunch? And I would see what was fresh, what was beautiful, and that's what I would get for lunch. And then in the late afternoon, I'd go back and select something for dinner.
Wow.
And that's a mentality that most people don't have. But then I would walk to the market. I didn't take a car.
Right. Well, actually, Peter does the driving when we travel, because we'd never get any place if I had to contend with the aggressive driver.
I know that.
But if I was cooking, I sure would walk to the market just like you.
Yes.
Well, here's a suggestion that I do to a lot of people, and not just for Bologna, but anywhere. The book has, for each region of Italy, what I call a classic town. And this doesn't mean the best town in the region, but it means the town that gathers within its walls much that is typical about the region. It happens that for Emilia-Romagna, I selected Bologna, which is a larger city than most of the ones I select. But the reason to do this is you settle in a city for 7 days. People who travel often say, well, I'm going to do 1 day in Florence and 2 days in Rome.
Yeah, I hate that.
That's no way to do that. You want to settle in, learn the means of transport to go out of town to visit nearby places, but otherwise get a little apartment with a kitchen and cook.
Mm-hmm.
And this way you go to the markets, and this way you can taste a whole range of ingredients that never land on restaurant tables. And if you choose to go out to a restaurant every so often, that's fine.
Mm-hmm. Fred, this has happened. I knew it was going to happen. We're running out of time, and we have too much more to say. Can we reschedule another date to get together and talk about Italy?
Of course.
Why don't we do that regularly? That would be kind of fun.
We'll call you when we get back from Bologna at the end of September.
Are you in Italy or in New York?
No, I will be in New York. The Metropolitan Opera opens its season at the end of September, so I will be in New York September and October. Most of September and all of October.
The book is called Italy for the
Gourmet Traveler. And Fred, do you have a web page just of your own?
I have not set it up. It is fredplotkin.com, but it's on my to-do list because I'm always traveling. I don't have time to
I understand.
Website.
We have the same problem. P-L-O-T-K-I-N.
Correct.
Listeners. And check out, if you're going to be in Italy, you'll have more information than you'll ever need in this wonderful book, Italy for the Gourmet Traveler. And Fred, you are an absolute delight, and I can't wait to take this book with me to Bologna.
Well, enjoy it. If anyone who goes to Bologna is a truly blessed person.
I love it. Enjoy your travels with it for public radio, which you're going to be doing soon. Hmm?
Yes, I'll be doing broadcasting from the opera festivals of Macerata, Pesaro, and Torre del Lago, because this year Puccini turns 150, and he lived in Torre del Lago.
Okay. Wow. All right, Fred. Good talking to you, as usual.
And
talk to you
soon.
And buon viaggio a lei.
Okay.
Ciao.
Ciao.
Well, as you said, we could talk to him forever. Everybody who's met him just raves and raves about him. And he has one of these incredible memories for every little detail.
I think he said he had a lot of notebooks, too.
Yeah, I think so. That does it, pretty much. We ought to wrap this show for this week. And we have lots more to talk to our listeners about, but that can carry over for a week.
If you can contain yourself for another week, there'll be more excitement here at onthemenuradio.com for you next Sunday or whenever you listen to the program. And we look forward always to being a part of your life, and we hope that you enjoy being a part of ours.
Bye-bye.